Welcome to Season 5 of Inspiring West Virginians. I'm Jean Snediger. West Virginia has produced a phenomenal number of scientists, engineers, and businessmen and women who are making an impact on a state, national, and global stage. Some of them are famous, others less so. But this is the series where you hear their stories. In the next hour, sit back, relax, and be amazed by four people we call inspiring West Virginians. First, a man from Wheeling who's working at the cutting edge of cancer drug research.
This is our clinical pharmacology laboratory. One of the many things we do here is to look at the blood concentrations of anti-cancer drugs.
I'm Bill Petros. I grew up in Wheeling, West Virginia, in Ohio County. And I am currently the Milan Chair of Pharmacology at West Virginia University. I'm also Associate Director for Anti-Cancer Drug Development at the Mary Babb Randolph Cancer Center at WVU.
53-year-old Bill Petros is one of the few clinical pharmacologists in the United States who does cutting-edge research into new cancer drugs. He also designs early drug trials to investigate why cancer drugs react differently from one person to the next.
Any two people that take a drug, sometimes the concentrations that one person has in their blood, even though they've gotten the same dose as the next person, vary over a 3 to 10-fold range or more. And that variability is important because it can determine why someone gets side effects versus another person doesn't, or why the drug works versus another person that doesn't.
Petros and his research team are learning why people react differently to a drug or combination of drugs, and how effective the drug treatment is. The number one variable is smoking.
Tobacco smoking can affect the body's ability to react to a drug. Sometimes it can accelerate its metabolism, or it could change it in other ways. And so one of the projects that I have going is we're trying to evaluate how a particular anti-cancer drug is affected by smoking.
So if a cancer patient continues to smoke, and some do, they may not be getting the right dose of the drug for their treatment.
So now we can measure down below 1 micromole of erysine.
Yes.
We can see quite well below one micromole,
so we can do our experiments now.
This is Dr. Terry McManus. Terry's a chemist, an analytic chemist. One of the things that we focus on here, as I said, measuring the blood concentrations of anti-cancer drugs. And one of the instruments that Terry's an expert at running is called a LC-MS.
If we're interested in the amount of a certain drug in a blood sample, the HPLC separates the different chemical compounds, including all the drugs, and the mass spectrometer measures them. We know how much, and we know the identity of the compound. So we can tell how quickly the drug is being metabolized by taking samples at different points in time.
Besides tobacco, Petros's lab looks at how body size, age, genetics, or body chemistry can affect how much of an anti-cancer drug a patient should receive. It's all part of the new world of personalized medicine. Bill Petros believes that West Virginia, which draws its patients mostly from the community rather than far away, is uniquely placed to carry out this kind of research. And here at the Mary Babb Randolph Cancer Center, research and treatment take place side by side.
So this is a treatment room for the cancer center. So this is where we administer just about all our drugs that were given to patients to treat their disease. When we do clinical research in patients and we draw blood samples, we almost always obtain them from this area. And that's why we set up our laboratory very close to that area.
Your laboratory is literally across the hall from where the patients are.
Yes. And that's important because just last year we processed over 8,500 samples. Okay, so now we're walking into the biospecimen processing laboratory. So those samples have to pass through this laboratory before they can go anywhere else. And right now we're probably running about 40 to 50 different protocols.
Following several different procedures, often using extremely sophisticated equipment, the research blood samples are studied here in Bill Petros's labs, or by other colleagues at the Health Sciences Center at WVU, or immediately FedEx to fellow research colleagues at other laboratories in the United States and in Europe.
So have we figured out how to optimize the bone marrow samples yet for our joint project?
We aren't exactly sure on what's causing the effect, but we have a plan to try to decipher it out by doing some experiments. So we'll try to initially...
One of the things that will strike you about Bill's work is that he's always thinking a year ahead of several other people.
Laura Gibson, leukemia researcher and deputy director of the Mary Babb Randolph Cancer Center.
For example, a huge wave in terms of personalized medicine. How can we best choose patients and match them to the therapy that's most likely to be impactful for them? And so while we're a relatively small institution compared to many, Bill is really talented in seeing what we have that's unique here, thinking about our populations in a way that he can weave those into cutting-edge science.
How cutting-edge is what Bill does?
One example of how he is doing very contemporary work is a statewide genomics network that he collaborates with a group from Marshall University. He leads our effort here. This is specifically focused on understanding cancer patients in West Virginia at a genetic level and how that precise information can be used to give them best care possible. That's the ultimate outcome of the work that he's helping drive with that group. That's the level of science that really moves an institution forward and moves the healthcare of a state forward.
For more than a decade, Bill Petros led his own research lab at Duke University Cancer Center, one of the top cancer research centers in the United States. Then, out of the blue, he got a call from West Virginia University.
I wasn't looking to move. I had multiple grants. I had multiple people working in my laboratory. And I asked myself when the call came, do I want to continue what I'm doing for the next 10 or 20 years? And sure, I can make an impact and nationally and et cetera. Or do I want to make that impact and in addition, help the people back home that really were the reason why I got into this in the beginning?
Petros felt a pull back to WVU, where he'd studied pharmacy and where he had first become interested in pharmaceutical research. But the fact that Bill Petros even considered a move from Duke to WVU puzzled many of his colleagues. But he saw new challenges and opportunities back in West Virginia, such as being able to develop early drug trials here. At the time, many people had to go out of state to get that kind of treatment.
We know about 20% of West Virginians actually travel outside the state boundaries to get care, and oftentimes that's because they're looking for a clinical trial that might not be offered in their area of the state. And we're trying to get together people around the state into a clinical trials network right now to be able to do that, and we've made some real inroads into that.
Plus, Petros and his wife Karen, also a research pharmacist and a West Virginian, wanted to raise their children here. So he waited until June 20th, then signed the WVU contract to honor his home state on its birthday.
Growing up in West Virginia is unique in many ways, and this was one of the reasons we moved back, too. I was living in an environment that we had people from all around the country. And you had a hard time sometimes grasping the community spirit. And here, it's vibrant. You can feel that spirit. When you say, where are you from? You talk to people that live out of state, and it's just like saying your nationality. They say they're from West Virginia, even though they might have lived out of state longer than they ever lived here. And I tell people that have been here a long time, you don't know how unique it is to you leaving and then see it from that perspective.
Bill Petros grew up in a modest, middle-class home in the Elm Grove area of Wheeling, West Virginia.
My dad was one of 13 kids. My grandparents were from Lebanon on that side. He worked hard all his life. He would call himself a tire man. My uncles and my grandfather had tire shops in Wheeling. And so he worked for them for a number of years and then kind of branched out on his own and had his own small business and went out and serviced truck tires. Worked extremely hard, typically 7 days a week, and would sometimes take me out. As I got older, I went out and actually had to do the hard work, swinging a sledgehammer, changing tires sometimes in the middle of the night in the snow on Interstate 70. I think for the purpose of making sure that, you know, I was going to do something different with my life than what he had to. My mother grew up in McMeekin, West Virginia, just south of Wheeling. And her mother actually passed away when she was about 12. And so she had to take care of three brothers as well as her dad for a while. And then she graduated from high school. and then went to Wheeling Hospital into their nursing program and got her RN there. And so she actually worked for Wheeling Hospital for a number of years, worked in the polio wards actually a lot, and, you know, tells me stories of, you know, back in the days they had to boil their own syringes and make the patients breakfast and dinners and things like that. It was much beyond your typical nurse duties nowadays.
Bill and his sister Marianne came along comparatively late in their parents' lives. The Petros' front porch became a gathering place where Bill's dad would entertain neighborhood kids with his jokes. In his younger days, Bill was a bit shy and reserved. He liked camping, fishing, and football.
But if you talked to some of my friends, they would probably vote me as like the person most likely to blow themselves up because I always like chemistry.
I am Bernie Glenn, an insurance agent from Wheeling, West Virginia, and I met Bill in the third grade. Bill would always seem to want to know a little bit more about things, whether it was in school or even out of school. He seemed to always have questions about something that he was interested in.
I'm Joe Palmer from Wheeling, West Virginia. I've known Bill Petros since 1974, my freshman year in high school. He loved his sciences. He loved his chemistry. So, you know, when he had a chance to really try to figure it out, we had a great chemistry teacher our senior year. He was only at Central for 1 year. He was very engaging, and Billy loved it.
I had a very inspiring teacher named Mr. Hockey. He said, "You guys are all on a clean slate to me, and I just want to inspire you. I want to teach you science and let you do it the way you want to." And we spent most of the time in the lab. He directed us in experiments, and he gave us confidence, and he made it learning fun. He made it so fun that, you know, as a freshman at WVU, I did well enough in chemistry that I became a teaching assistant my sophomore year and went back and taught some of his classes, too, in high school.
And it wasn't just school that Bill was interested in.
He liked cars a lot and was very interested in the engines and the power, and he liked music. And
loud music.
Loud music.
Very and, loud and, music he, in his car.
He liked a lot of power.
He was a great dresser in high school.
He was. I looked to see what he was wearing and try to find out where he bought it from and sneak down there.
And Bill, I think he was even voted best dressed our senior year. He was a nifty dresser.
Bill Petros went on to study pharmacy at West Virginia University, then did a residency in pharmacy in Florida, then a doctor of pharmacy in Philadelphia, where he became interested in cancer and infectious disease. Finally, he decided to do a research fellowship in clinical pharmacology. He founded at St. Jude's Children's Hospital in Memphis, Tennessee, which had one of the best cancer research fellowships in the nation, perhaps the world.
The mentor that I had there, his name's Bill Evans, and in the pharmacy world, he's like probably the most recognized pharmacy researcher in the clinical area. Was a fantastic mentor, and we were working on these genomic issues before they were even on the page of most people.
Once he finished his research fellowship, Duke University School of Medicine recruited Bill Petros to head up the clinical pharmacology lab in their cancer center. Friends Bernie Glenn and Joe Palmer.
Watching his career, I guess what I'm most proud of is that he would come back to West Virginia to do this. And I think that he just cares so much about the school, the state. He's very proud of who he is and where he came from. He left a very good position at Duke University. It didn't leave easily, but his heart was in Morgantown, West Virginia.
Yeah. I don't even think the money was a factor. It was being able to come back home and raise his kids back here and educate him back here and be home.
The environment here between the basic scientists and the clinicians is very unique, and they love working with each other and they love listening to each other. I've been at many places around the country and during my training and work, and it's very unique, I think, and it's reflective of West Virginia. The other side of that is a sense of belonging and a sense of being from a unique place. The stamp that West Virginia puts on you and the picture you have of the state in your mind. Maybe it was, you know, growing up and looking out the window and always seeing a mountain. Or the way the sun sets, the way the sun comes up, the way, you know, the shadows are. It's just something that gets instilled in your mind. I never felt like I was home until I came back.
Up next, a man from Moundsville who used early supercomputers to imagine what the universe looks like. And as it turns out, he was right.
Chuck Yeager flew fast, faster than these sentences, than even their sound. Homer Hickam dreamed the sky itself, shaped rockets, then words to tell his story. And Adrian Malott reached between the stars to the dark matter, dreamed the very structure of the cosmos.
West Virginia poet laureate Mark Harshman reading a verse from his sesquicentennial poem, A Song for West Virginia.
My name is Adrian Malott. I was born and raised in Moundsville, West Virginia, along the Ohio River in Marshall County. I now live in Lawrence, Kansas, and I'm a professor of physics at the University of Kansas. I'm also a theorist, which means that I don't do experiments, but I look at experimental data and I try to understand what's going on and find explanations for it.
Theoretical physicists and cosmologists like Adrian Malott use mathematical models to explain why certain things happen the way they do. Back in the early 1980s, Malott was a pioneer in imagining what the large-scale structure of the universe might look like.
Large-scale structure in the universe, the way it's used today, means structure on scales of tens and hundreds of millions of light years. So the way the galaxies are arranged on those scales is kind of in a frothy, web-like structure where the galaxies are concentrated along strings and walls, and there are large empty voids.
As a graduate student in physics in the early 1980s, Adrian Malott first got interested in how the universe is organized. New technology came to his aid.
So what I did, basically, was start doing simulations on supercomputers that had really very, very large amounts of particles. And you have to have a lot of particles in order to see that frothy, web-like structure.
Then Malott published his findings.
At first it was ignored because most people who worked on large-scale structure in England and America didn't believe in the existence of these filaments and voids and so forth. But after a few years, interest began to pick up because more data from astronomers came in that showed that that kind of structure is actually really there.
When Adrian Malott, now 67, started this work, there were only two other groups of people in the world doing something similar. One at the University of California, Berkeley, and the other in Moscow. At the time, Sergei Chandran was one of the people in Moscow. He was a research fellow at the USSR Academy of Sciences. He knew that Adrian Malott was following the theoretical model of the universe that his mentor, the great physicist and cosmologist Yakov Sidoyevich, had first proposed. But Adrian took it a step further. On supercomputers, he started running something called n-body simulations.
N-body simulations is computation, the trajectories of particles, which mimics galaxies or some object in the universe moving under the action of gravity. These simulations nowadays is a commonplace. Lots of people do that. But in the 80s, it was difficult to make the simulations even in the West with better computers than in the Soviet Union. Adrian did first pioneering simulations in the United States and in the frame of the model suggested by Sidoyevich.
About that time, Chandran, who is now a professor of cosmology at the University of Kansas, was one of the first people to use the term cosmic web to describe this large-scale structure of the universe that Adrian envisaged.
Okay, so this is sort of a three-dimensional drawing of...
Yes, a three-dimensional structure, how it may look, and it's a technical thing, but the mass is concentrated in these thin layers, like Sidoyevich called them pancakes.
Are these sort of...
Together, Malott and Chandran did further work on the cosmic web and Sidoyevich pancakes. Dark matter plays a crucial role in the formation of the web-like structure.
Tell me briefly what dark matter is.
I don't know.
You don't know what dark matter is. You're supposed to be an expert in dark matter.
I don't know, and nobody else does either.
It's theoretical, whatever dark matter is.
No, there's a lot of experimental evidence. Basically, dark matter is explained by actions of gravity when you can't see anything. So you know something is there, but you can't see it. Suppose you saw a spaceship that had its engines turned off and was traveling around in circles. You'd say, well, it must be orbiting some dark thing. So it's kind of like that. And actually now we know, you know, the universe is something like 27% dark matter. But whatever the stuff is, you can't see it. It doesn't glow or anything. It pretty much goes right through the Earth without doing anything. So it's very hard to detect.
In 2003, you dramatically changed your career.
Yeah, I made a big switch. The way that happened, we had a person come and interview for a faculty job, and he gave a talk about gamma ray bursts, which are very powerful explosions, actually the most powerful explosions known in the universe. There's about one a day going off in the universe today. So I said to him, what would happen if one of these went off in our galaxy? And he thought for a minute and said, that would not be good. So actually, he did come here, and we decided to consider this idea that you might explain some of the big mass extinctions that have happened on Earth as being an effect of gamma ray bursts.
You mean like the extinction of the dinosaurs?
Well, not that one, because that's pretty clearly the result of a big rock. In the last 500 million years, there have been five really big ones, and about 15 more sort of medium-sized extinctions, disasters, and we don't know what caused them.
After years of working at the forefront of cosmology, Adrian enthusiastically began to study the possible effect of gamma ray bursts on Earth. Since it incorporates elements of astrophysics, astronomy, biology, biochemistry, paleontology, and atmospheric science, among others, Malott named the new field astrobiophysics.
For me, the word astrobiophysics is an attempt to encapsulate everything that we do.
Astrophysicist Brian Thomas of Washburn University in Topeka, Kansas. Over the last 10 years, Malott and Thomas have published numerous papers in astrobiophysics.
It's hard to categorize Adrian. I think he's something of a category unto himself. He's definitely been a leader in cosmology, and he's been a leader in this newer field of connecting astrophysics to biology. The way I always picture him is very much like Santa Claus in looks, but a little bit grumpier. He's a very nice guy, but he also will tell you exactly what he thinks, and he's full of ideas.
Malott and Thomas's groundbreaking work into the effects of gamma ray bursts has been featured on the National Geographic Channel and the Weather Channel.
Would this gamma ray burst mean the end of any civilization as we know it?
Not necessarily. It depends on how much power you get, how far away is it, and what's the intensity, is it exactly pointed at the Earth. You can have anything from a huge mass extinction. Probably you wouldn't kill off all the people on Earth, but maybe the ones that are left would wish they were dead.
Professor Malott's curiosity about space and the universe first came from his grandfather.
He read books on cosmology as it was known and understood in the 50s and early 60s. And my father and my grandfather were both interested in science a good bit, so we talked about things. And I had a little chemistry lab in the basement when I was a kid, and I was given free rein to poison myself and the rest of my family, played with things that would horrify people today. My dad was a machinist. He originally worked for a corporation. That corporation moved to New York State. He said, I'm not leaving. So they valued him enough to set him up with his own shop in Moundsville. So he became the smallest division of Sterling Drug. He basically built machines that would go into their factories. My mother is still living in Moundsville, and she's feisty and strong, but she's, what, 91? About a year and a half ago, I had to yell at her to keep her from going up on the roof to get branches off the roof.
I'm Kathleen Malott, Adrian Malott's mother.
And here we are in Moundsville. Is that Adrian right there?
That's Adrian. And there is his little brother Brian looking on.
Adrian Malott does original research on diffusion through gels. This is March 1962. The Moundsville Daily Echo.
He was very studious even when he was little. He used to visit the neighbors and tell them how he was going to the moon.
What did you think would happen to him?
Well, I was very confident that he would really do big things because he was always, from the very beginning, interested in everything. He was just up with current things. He always read extra stuff. He always went to the library and found out, you know, different things that they didn't teach in school.
I remember him as being very scientific-oriented, very knowledgeable, very serious-minded student.
Nyla Meadows, a childhood friend of Adrian's.
I notice you've got your yearbook.
Adrian's senior class picture. He was content to follow when he leads the way. He was also voted most confident in the senior class.
That's interesting.
That's very interesting.
I had a high school teacher named Robert Fish at Moundsville High School who was a real inspiration. He knew a lot of chemistry. He was interested in it and gave me free rein to learn stuff there.
So free that once Moundsville High School had to be evacuated after one of Adrian's chemistry experiments went wrong.
I won't name the chemical. I spilled a small amount of it. It smells like rotten butter, and that smell wafted out into the building, and people started getting sick, and like 1,000 students were sent home because of me.
Despite his chemistry mishaps, Adrian was a National Merit Scholar and was offered generous scholarship money to go to WVU and MIT, among others. But he chose to go to Bethany College in West Virginia, where he became president of the student body. Then he took an interesting turn in his career. Between finishing college and embarking on his Ph.D. in physics, Adrian Malott spent 7 years as a Unitarian Universalist minister.
While I was a minister, a member of my church said, "Oh, by the way, I'm going to teach a certain physics course at the local university next fall. Would you like to sit in?" He knew I had a physics undergraduate degree. So I thought, yeah, okay, why not? So I started taking one course at a time. And after about 3 years, I had enough courses to get a master's degree.
And that drew Adrian back to a full-time science career. When he got to the University of Texas in Austin, his Ph.D. supervisor was the well-known British physicist Denis Sciama, one of the fathers of modern cosmology. Sciama also supervised Stephen Hawking, now the world's most famous living scientist.
Denis Sciama was actually the supervisor of a whole generation of people who are really important in astrophysics. A part of it was the way he treated people. He made them value their own ideas and how to proceed forward with their own ideas.
Since finishing his Ph.D., Adrian Malott has spent most of his scientific career at the University of Kansas. He has received many prestigious awards and honors for his contributions to cosmology and education. Adrian Malott once dreamed the structure of the universe, and over decades, the evidence of astronomers proved that his ideas were pretty accurate. But he's still full of new ideas and loves the sheer fun of working as a scientist.
The most exciting thing about what I do is actually discovering something new. For a short time, you can realize, oh, I'm the only person in the world that understands that, and that's great. What I'm hoping to accomplish in the days ahead actually is now very specific. I want to understand what may happen to the Earth when a supernova goes off nearby. And in particular, what happened about 2.5 million years ago, because now there is evidence that a supernova went off then, and we just got a research grant to investigate that. I hope my legacy will be people willing to mix in physics with other things to try to understand what's happened to the Earth.
You're listening to Season 5 of Inspiring West Virginians, profiles of scientists and business people from the great state of West Virginia. Next, an African-American doctor from Bluefield who is responsible for 1 million patients. Not only that, she's changing the way we practice medicine in the United States.
Well, my name is Dr. Patrice Harris, and I am originally from Bluefield, West Virginia. That's Mercer County. I'm a child, adolescent, and forensic psychiatrist here in Atlanta, Georgia. I'm currently the district health director for Fulton County, which is home to the city of Atlanta. I usually say I have 1 million patients in the day and about 800,000 patients at night.
Hold on a second. It says download accreditation PDF report, so let's look at that.
That's on the left.
400 staff in several health centers across Fulton County report to 54-year-old Dr. Harris, one of the nation's leading psychiatrists.
As a psychiatrist, of course, I am a medical doctor, and I do meet with children and their families who are having issues and identify what I think the issues are and work with the child and the family to develop some potential solutions. I'm very solution focused. Folks tease me. They say I'm a surgeon psychiatrist, and I call myself a surgeon psychiatrist because I do like to get in and get out. And I think child and adolescent psychiatrists are in the business of the promotion of socio-emotional and behavioral health.
Patrice Harris has spent much of her career serving the wider mental health community at the city, state, and national level. But among her proudest accomplishments are 3 new public health facilities in Atlanta.
This is our 3rd center that we built looking at the future of healthcare delivery.
I met her at the Oak Hill Child, Adolescent, and Family Center. It opened about a year ago.
Healthcare delivery has been fragmented and siloed, and also has lacked a focus on the social determinants of health. The social determinants of health, where you live, work, and play, can affect your health almost as much as whether or not you have access to a physician.
Designed and renovated under Dr. Harris's supervision, this is the first facility in the United States which integrates primary care, public health services, mental health services, educational and job training services for youngsters, all under one roof. Here, a child or adolescent, for example, can see a psychiatrist or a counselor, a pediatrician, dentist or nurse, and a whole lot more.
This campus also focuses on childhood obesity. It makes me think about West Virginia because we are fighting some similar battles. In this campus, we have a gymnasium and we have a walking trail.
Plus an amazing playground and something not many other public health facilities have.
In here is our teaching kitchen. If you think about childhood obesity, if you think about health in general, what is more important than nutrition? We said we probably need to teach our families how to prepare healthy and nutritious meals. We have a garden right outside of the teaching kitchen. So our children are able to plant vegetables and then come into the teaching kitchen and learn how to prepare them in a healthy and nutritious way. So we are so excited about this teaching kitchen.
And how are the kids taking to it so far?
They absolutely love it. They love it. In a previous class, we had a child say, "Mommy, I didn't know vegetables could taste this good." So we're passing by here some classrooms. I call this the...
We visit several classrooms, a beautiful library, a reading room for children, a medical wing, a dental wing, a daycare center. Everything about this facility, the buildings, the furnishings, and the 22-acre campus itself, shouts beauty. Out of most windows, you see a view of trees and green grass. It's an inviting, calming place.
She's always said that the Oak Hill facility that we're at now, which is integrated care for children, youth, and families, would be something that was a dream.
Charles Relaford, Chief of Staff for Fulton County Health Services.
We did not know we'd get here, didn't know how we were going to pay for it, had no idea about all that. But it started literally as a dream, and now it has come to fruition, and it was her dream.
Relaford adds that Patrice Harris's accomplishments, including her current service on the board of the American Medical Association, have become a role model for African-American men and women in the Atlanta area.
coming from West Virginia, being an African-American female person, and I think that that is a unique perspective. Coming to Atlanta, which is kind of the mecca, you know, of African-Americans in the South, everything kind of came together, and I think it's a positive for our region, and we're just proud to have her here with us.
Long before Patrice Harris ever dreamed of being a national leader in healthcare, she dreamed of being a doctor. It started in middle school in Bluefield, West Virginia.
I was inspired by Marcus Welby. In the 70s, Marcus Welby, MD, was the name of the TV show. And Marcus Welby was this kind, benevolent, caring family physician who solved everyone's problems in the hour-long TV show. And I knew that I wanted to be like that. And it never dawned on me that I couldn't just absolutely do anything that I want to do, even though I didn't know personally any physicians, particularly in the African-American community at that time. I am an only child. I'm the daughter of Barbara and Titus Harris. My mother was a junior high and later middle school math and science teacher. I was in her class in the eighth grade. I refused to call her Miss Harris. So when I wanted to answer a question, I just raised my hand and waved wildly, hoping that I would get her attention. My father worked on the railroad all of his life. Originally, it was Norfolk West Railroad, and then I think it's Norfolk Southern by the time he retired as a conductor.
In 2007, Patrice's mother, Barbara, died, and her father now lives with her in Atlanta. But growing up, Harris's parents encouraged her in everything she did.
We have some old home movies, and there is a movie of me, and I was probably, I don't know, maybe 5 or 6. My mother was filming my father just holding me up in the air and, you know, how parents do children and just playing and laughing. And that lasted several minutes. And then there's a film of my mom doing the same thing. And I remember it hit me and I said, that's why I'm a physician, because I had that love and support of two parents. They didn't even have to overtly tell me you can be what I wanted to be. I just knew it.
Both of Patrice Harris's grandfathers were coal miners, and she had lots of aunts, uncles, and cousins in Bluefield. So she had the experience of being an only child inside a big extended family. She claimed she was bossy as a kid, ordering her cousins around. But she was also a majorette and a good student, graduating second in her class at Bluefield High School. While she was still in high school, her family went to a football game at WVU.
Our neighbor's adopted son played football at West Virginia. That meant that all of us on the street were WVU football fans. And so my family went up to a WVU football game in 1975, and I just knew I was going to West Virginia. Virginia Tech is closer to me, but I'm just a West Virginia girl, true and true, and it just never dawned on me that I was going anywhere else but West Virginia University.
Once she got to West Virginia University, Patrice didn't have a clue what to study to become a doctor, so she pursued it in sort of a roundabout way. Her advisor encouraged her to apply to nursing school, but Patrice decided that wasn't for her and ended up studying psychology. And then she did a master's in counseling. She worked at the Student Counseling Center and in minority student recruitment. Then finally, ended up in medical school.
And I have to tell you, I've really done a lot of that in life. I think I have these long-term plans and goals, but I'm very flexible. I was doing a phone interview once, and the person said, "What were your long-term goals?" And I said, "To do good and to do well."
While she was at West Virginia University, Patrice Harris certainly did well. She was involved in all kinds of organizations and became president of her sorority and the Black Unity Organization.
When I went to West Virginia, there were about 200 and some odd African-American students, many of them on the football team. We were very close, and I remain friends with many of the folks that I started with and many of the folks that I went to school with, because I was in Morgantown for years, an undergraduate in graduate school and medical school.
After medical school, Harris wanted to go to a warmer place with a more diverse population. She chose Emory University in Atlanta to do her residency in child psychiatry and forensic psychiatry. And after a stint working at the Georgia General Assembly, she discovered she loved policy and the legislative process.
I saw how the legislative process can affect medical practice, and I enjoyed it. So long story short, I started going to the Capitol full time.
Patrice Harris became an expert on issues surrounding abused and neglected children, and for several years was a senior policy fellow and adjunct professor at the Emory University School of Law. She also serves on the Board of Trustees of the American Medical Association.
What I love about my job is the ability to make a difference on a global scale. But I do enjoy systems change, because I think when you affect systems change, you affect and have the opportunity to help more people. So I love that piece.
Yeah, we make sure it says Oak Hill
Child, Adolescent, and Family Center.
Mm-hmm. Especially when you first walk in the door. It would
right.
be nice.
Right.
She's funny, and she will always tell you what she thinks. She gives really honest and good feedback, and you leave feeling like, oh, I hadn't thought about it that way.
Jennifer Bartle, Program Manager at the Oak Hill Center.
She's just trailblazing. She's paving the way for women. She's paving the way for African-American women. She's the first African-American female supervisor that I've had that was just really inspiring to me. Personally, she loves shoes and purses. Her office is filled with them.
Not only is Patrice Harris a shoe fanatic, she's a foodie. She loves to eat out, and as head of public health for Fulton County, her team inspects more than 4,500 restaurants in the Atlanta area. She's also a sports fanatic.
I'm an avid sports fan. I've been watching professional football since I was 10 years old, and I love sports, and I'm a season ticket holder to the Falcons.
And follows West Virginia University just as passionately.
Here we are in Morgantown, and I am so happy to take you on a journey. I am taking you to the new Alumni Center, the Erickson Alumni Center.
Yeah.
And the reason I'm taking you here is because it represents an event that reconnected me to the university. After I graduated in 1992, as you know, I went to Atlanta, and I didn't come back. I didn't come back for a long while. I just didn't have that connection to the university. I got a call one day, and it said, congratulations, you are going to be inducted into the West Virginia University Academy of Distinguished Alumni. And I think I said, great, wonderful, that's a great honor. I came to Morgantown. I was ready to enter the room with all the hundreds of guests, and I broke down in tears. It hit me at that moment, the honor that was, and it hit me at that moment that West Virginia University appreciated me and was recognizing my accomplishments and that the university was proud of me. And so we're walking into the Alumni Center because it was at that dinner that I reconnected with the university, and I plan to stay connected to the university from now on.
We're just about to walk through the doors into the Erickson Alumni Center.
I think I have a strong sense of who I am and an identity. I think that being from West Virginia, it builds some strength. I think that makes all of us West Virginians strong, sturdy folk. You know, small town, close-knit community, strong sense of family. Appreciating your history. I'm very proud that West Virginia was formed during the Civil War. I'm very proud that West Virginia was formed because we didn't want to go with slavery. I'm just proud of that.
What do you see in your future?
I want to continue to stay involved in organized medicine. I want to continue to be at leadership in organized medicine. I would love to look at, and I am looking at, ways to marry my love of sports with my medical specialty. So I'm looking at that. But I am looking forward just to mainly taking one day at a time and really enjoying every day, not taking any day for granted. Not taking anyone for granted and just doing the best that I can. I want to be 80, and if I'm 80 or 90 and sitting on the porch, I want to say that I did well and I did good.
Mm-hmm. Before our final story in this season of Inspiring West Virginians, we hear from a man who grew up poor in Preston County. Yet today, he's trying to solve one of the world's most difficult problems, extreme poverty.
Okay, Jake, we're here in your house. Mm-hmm. This is the house you grew up in.
Right.
Most of your life you spent right here?
My whole life, yeah.
Your whole life you spent
here? I mean my whole life till I was 17.
And where are you taking me now?
I thought we'd go across, kind of show you some of the farm.
40-year-old Jake Harriman shows me his home place, the small wooden house and farm where he grew up. It's in the Wetzel Settlement, a tiny community on top of a hill in Preston County, West Virginia. The oldest of four children, Jake is tall, blonde, and looks like a football player. When he was growing up, his family was considered poor.
Technically, we did live in poverty when I was growing up. According to the government standard of living on less than $20,000 annually, but I remember growing up, I never really felt like we were poor. I never felt like I wanted for anything. So this is a field much smaller than it was before where we used to plant all our food.
Jake's family raised their own food and hunted for most of their meat. His dad worked several jobs to support the family and built their farmhouse himself. Everybody worked hard, but they had fun too.
This hillside used to be just packed full of briars, and so we used to make forts and tunnels in the briars, actually, just like the rabbits, you know, and we used to play war and other stuff in here. You can look across the river, and that's Preston High on the other side of the river there. There's parts of Kingwood you can see. There's a little spring right over this hill here by these trees, and it was kind of like this little magical place that we would go as kids to kind of like dream about big stuff, you know, like, what do we want to be when we grow up? You know, where are we going to go? It was a secret. You could always kind of go here and get away and nobody would ever find you. I used to dream big there and try to figure out how I was going to make a difference in the world.
Who would have guessed then that a poor farm boy from rural West Virginia would one day try to tackle, head on, one of the world's biggest problems, extreme poverty? But that's what Jake Harriman, former Marine platoon commander and now social entrepreneur, is trying to do. 6 years ago, he started an organization called Nuru International.
Nuru gave me a loan of maize seed and fertilizer, and I am working harder than ever before. I believe that with Nuru, for the first time, my children will not know a single day of hunger.
Nuru International is an organization that was built to defeat extreme poverty in remote rural areas around the world. So we're trying to build the world's first self-sustainable, self-scalable, integrated development model to fight extreme poverty. I say integrated, it's a four-pronged approach. We attack the needs of hunger, inability to cope with economic shock, preventable disease and death, and lack of quality education for children.
Nuru started in rural Kenya. But unlike most other development organizations, Nuru doesn't give handouts, nor build schools or dig wells.
To mobilize communities and make real change at the grassroots level, you have to focus on leaders who are embedded in the community, who their community already trusts and respects. I think that's one of the true keys to success, whether it's rural Appalachia or, you know, Kenya or Ethiopia or wherever.
Nuru defines extreme poverty not in strict economic terms, but as the lack of meaningful choices for basic human rights. When they go into a new area, they ask the community members themselves what they believe they need to come out of poverty, then listen to their suggestions. They train local leaders in farming, business, and management skills. Give them loans to start small businesses, so that the community members are able to pull themselves and their neighbors out of poverty and stay out. It's called bottom-up development.
Before Nuru came, I was harvesting 3 sacks of maize per hectare. Now I'm getting 18. After this harvest, I'll repay my agriculture loan, save some for eating, and sell the rest. With that money, I believe I'll be able to build my own house.
One of the keys to success in this work is you have to focus on the people and you have to unleash the potential that's already located within those trapped in poverty. Help them become part of the solution.
In Swahili, the word Nuru means light or hope. Over the last 7 years, Jay Karaman and his colleagues at Nehru have tested this bottom-up approach to ending extreme poverty in the Kuria district of Kenya and in Ethiopia.
We want to open source our model. We want to share it with other organizations and governments and train them how to use it so that we can spread the success of this model and the impact of giving people more and more people choices more quickly.
Their goal is big: to end extreme poverty in remote rural areas in our lifetime. But the man with this big vision started small. From rural Preston County, Jake studied engineering at West Virginia University and later graduated from the U.S. Naval Academy. From there, he spent nearly 8 years as a Marine platoon commander in special operations and was awarded a Bronze Star. In 2003, Jake experienced a day in combat that changed his life forever. On a road in southern Iraq, he saw a man he thought was a terrorist coming toward him, and he was about to kill the man. Then he realized the man was just a poor farmer trying to escape with his family behind American lines. Within 50 yards of Jake, Saddam's forces shot the man's wife and children.
This guy was, beside himself, and for the first time in the war, everything slowed down for me, and I put myself in this guy's shoes. What choices did this guy have when he woke up this morning? He could watch his kids starve to death, strap a bomb to himself, or he could try to make some desperate attempt to cross our lines, So I didn't know what to do. I just let my weapon hang at my side and just started crying with this guy. Then I got really, really angry. And I thought, I never want to see another look in another human being's eyes like this ever again. And I felt like that was the beginning of an awakening in me. And so I thought that maybe I can make even more of an impact on the world on terror myself if I got out and tackle what I believe is the leading contributor to the proliferation of terrorism and insurgency and kind of general global instability, which is extreme poverty.
Harriman left the Marines and spent 18 months studying extreme poverty. He applied and was accepted at the Social Entrepreneurship Program at the Stanford Graduate School of Business, where he recruited 30 of his classmates and 6 faculty members to help him start Nehru International. Today, more than 30,000 people who once lived in extreme poverty have had their lives transformed. From the time he was a little boy, Jake had the makings of a leader, sort of.
I was always bossy. I always bossed my sisters around and had to have my way about everything. I was very domineering. My little brother, we were only 17 months apart. He's my best friend now, and he hated me growing up. One of our neighbors would ask us a question, and I would just answer for him, never give him an opportunity to answer anything. And I think that was tough for my siblings kind of growing up. So my father is one of the most inspiring men that I know. He's one of my heroes. I learned a lot from my dad. There's one story in particular I think that just burned in me and stayed with me. I was probably 7 or 8, I think, and my dad and I were building fence. My dad had the sledgehammer and he was pounding in the locust posts, and I was given the task of holding the posts as he hammered it in. And I remember, he was swinging that hammer really fast and really hard, and I remember just saying, starting almost to cry and say, "Dad, I just can't do this. I can't do this. I'm afraid." And he stopped, sat down on the tailgate of the truck, and he lifted me up and set me next to him. And he said, "Listen, son, I never want to hear those words out of your mouth again. Don't ever say I can't. You can do anything in this world that you want to do. You just have to put your mind to it, and you have to never give up." That stuck with me.
Jake was always somewhat of an overachiever.
Jake's father, Mike Harriman.
One time he burned his report card because he had all A's back in the barn. He certainly didn't want to be identified as a geek. But no matter what happened, he was always doing his best and always was, I think he was valedictorian of his first class here at Preston High School.
When Jake was a kid, he was the leader of all the other kids.
Jake's mother, Jan Harriman.
He was a pioneer. He was extremely compassionate. He's a wonderfully loving child.
I learned a lot from my mom about compassion and mercy and how to really love people. I always had a special place in my heart from a very young age for those who were trapped in poverty, way worse poverty than we lived. And it was because of my mother. She would tell stories about her growing up in school in Albright and the kids that she, you know, was would go to school and not have any food for lunch and, you know, the things that she would do to help them out. And that was always really inspirational for me. My mom taught me a lot as a young kid about faith and about God. I believe that Jesus wants me to love people by loving them in action. And I think he has a special place in his heart for the poor. You know, NURU is not a religious organization. We don't do anything with churches or proselytization. We just have poverty fighting activities and programs. But that is what drives me.
The main thing is he's driven. He's a driven child. He's driven by wanting to serve the Lord in a way that brings glory to him. And he searched and searched and searched for a way. And everything in his life that he's done, we believe, has led him to do what he's doing now.
Folks trapped in poverty are incredibly resourceful, intelligent, and innovative. They find a way. You know, like when you're up against a wall, you find a way. My parents always found a way to get us to school. They found a way to keep food on the table. You know, I mean, and that really inspired me. That perseverance, that can-do attitude. And that's something I'm so proud of, you know, in my West Virginia background and upbringing, you know, being able to be attached to a hardworking, dedicated people like that who, though trapped in poverty, are brave, courageous, innovative, resourceful people who never give up.
But what, I wondered, made a poor kid from West Virginia think that he could tackle something so audacious to try to change the world in a way that no one has ever done before?
I love it when you say that, because when people say that, it makes me want to do it even more. People from West Virginia have a spirit that you just can't quench. And the best way to get them to achieve something is tell them they can't do it. If you want to get me angry and you want to get me on fire and run through a brick wall, tell me I can't get to the other side of that brick wall. And I'll do it. Coming out of that culture and having that understanding about how life works really motivated me, you know, growing up. And again, my dad. My dad telling me on that fence row, saying, son, you're going to be able to do whatever you want to in this world. And for whatever reason, I believe that. I may fail at what I'm attempting to do. I don't think I will. We're on a very exciting trajectory. I think we're about to have some really groundbreaking success, but I might fail. But if I fail, I don't have to worry about the question, the nagging question, when I'm on my last days, did I ever try? Did I ever try to take on something that no one else has been able to figure out in giving hope and choices to other people? I can answer that question and say, yes, I gave everything I had in my life to try to do that.
You've been listening to Season 5 of Inspiring West Virginians, men and women from the Mountain State who are outstanding leaders in science and in business. Inspiring West Virginians was produced and presented by Gene Snediger. The senior producer for West Virginia Public Broadcasting is Suzanne Higgins. The Inspiring West Virginians theme music is by Roma Yagnik. Other music by Manuel Martini and Matthias Kayserer. Special thanks go to the Mary Babb Randolph Cancer Center at West Virginia University, the University of Kansas, to West Virginia Poet Laureate Mark Harshman and the folks at Mountain Stage, to the Oak Hill Child, Adolescent, and Family Center in Atlanta, Georgia, to NURU International, to Glynis Board and John Nakashima at West Virginia Public Broadcasting, and to Davis and Elkins College in Elkins, West Virginia. Inspiring West Virginians is made possible by the ongoing generous support of the Miles Family Foundation. Inspiring West Virginians to soar.